POWs and civilian captives. Villagers told the prisoners of hundreds of POW bodies lying in the jungle. A notoriously sadistic camp official began speaking of his sympathy for the POWs and how they'd soon be taken to a new camp where there was ample food, medical care, and no more slavery. The POWs knew it was a lie. In the camp office sat written orders for all captives to be liquidated on September 15th. Women and children would be poisoned, civilian men would be shot, the sick would be bayoneted. The 500 POWs would be marched into the jungle, shot, and burned. At camps across Japan, things looked just as ominous. At Omori, some Japanese warned the POWs that plans were set for prisoners to be shot. At other camps, machine guns and barrels of accelerant were brought in, and POWs' dog tags were confiscated in an apparent effort to not leave any traces. Prisoners were ordered to dig mysterious tunnels, and at several camps, friendly guards warned POWs that mines, ditches, and tunnels were going to be used as death chambers. At Phil and Fred Garrett's camp, officials suddenly announced that American POWs were being moved to a pleasant new camp for their safety. The men were taken by train across Japan through rivers of refugees and charred cities. The air smelled of burned bodies. After dark, they reached a remote area and were told to walk up a trail winding up a mountain. In a crashing rainstorm, they climbed for hours. Garrett, his stump still unhealed, labored on his crutches, and the guards wouldn't allow anyone to help him. The Japanese drove the group on for 11 miles. Men fainted from exhaustion. At 2 a.m., they reached a collection of wooden shacks high on the mountain. There, they collapsed. This was their new camp, Rokuroshi. No one explained why they'd been taken to a place so remote. The POW physician looked around and came to a conclusion. They'll kill us here. At Naoetsu, officials announced that POWs would soon be taken into the mountains to protect them from air raids. The guards told a different story, saying the army had issued orders to kill the POWs in August. This might have been dismissed as a lie, but a friendly civilian warned that an execution date was set. The same date was reportedly mentioned to prisoners in at least two other camps. All Naoetsu POWs, the civilian said, would be killed on August 22nd. Chapter 30. The Boiling City. No one in Naoetsu was sleeping. B-29s crossed over every night, sirens wailed, and the birds spun deeper into madness. As the bombers thundered over, the bird would crash into the barracks, ordering the Americans out. Shouting and swinging clubs, kendo sticks, or rifles, he'd shove them into two lines and make them slap each other's faces. Sometimes he'd make them stand with arms raised for hours, pounding them when their arms sagged. During one beating, Louis was clubbed on his injured ankle, leaving it so painful he could barely walk. And on at least one night, the bird beat Louis to unconsciousness. Louis's job as pig custodian was over. Barge work had also been canceled. So many Japanese ships had been sunk that none came to Naoetsu anymore. Louis was back on half rations. Limping, ill, and starved, he pleaded with the bird for work to get full rations. The bird brought him a sickly, paper-thin goat. "Goat die, you die." Louis nursed the goat and at night tied him in a grain shack. The goat got sicker. One morning the bird ordered Louis to come before him. He said the goat had escaped, gorged himself on grain, and became deathly ill, and it was Louis's fault. Louis knew his knot had been secure. If the goat had gotten loose, someone had untied him. He knew that person was almost certainly the bird himself. The goat died. Terrified of retribution, Louis hid in the barracks, but his diarrhea was killing him. Risking being seen by the bird, he snuck out, trying to get to the camp doctor. The bird spotted him and ran him down. The bird hustled Louis across the compound. Lying on the ground was a heavy wooden beam, some 6 feet long. "Pick it up," the bird said. Louis hoisted it, and the bird ordered him to lift it over his head. Louis heaved it up. The bird called a guard. "If the prisoner lowers his arms," the bird said, "ram him with your gun." He walked to a nearby shack, climbed on the roof, and settled in to watch. Louis stood in the sun, holding the beam. The bird stretched over the roof, calling to passing guards, pointing to Louis and laughing. Louis locked his eyes on the bird's face, seething. Minutes passed. Louis stood, eyes on the bird. The beam felt heavier and heavier. The bird stared, mocking him. Nearby, Wade and Tinker watched anxiously. Wade had looked at the camp clock when Louis had lifted the beam. He was increasingly conscious of how much time was passing. 5 more minutes passed, then 10. Louis's arms went numb. He shook. The beam tipped. The guard jabbed him, and he straightened. He began to feel confused, the camp swimming around him. All he knew was a single thought. "He cannot break me." Time ticked on, and still Louis remained, the beam over his head, his eyes on the bird's face, enduring long past when he should have collapsed. The bird stopped laughing. Frustrated and furious, the bird jumped down, charged across the compound, and rammed his fist into Louis's stomach. Louis crumpled in agony, and the beam dropped, striking his head. He flopped to the ground. When he woke, Wade was crouched by him. He had no idea how long he'd stood there, but Wade had looked at the clock when Louis had fallen. Louis had held the beam for 37 minutes. On the night of August 1st, the sirens suddenly began blasting and the air filled with a shattering roar. Above was an awesome spectacle. Wave after wave of B-29s, part of the biggest raid, by tonnage, of World War II. As they swept overhead, the bird raced into the barracks and shouted for all Americans to get out. The men hurried outside, and the bird began smashing them over their heads with his kendo stick. Men started falling. Louis went down, and the bird pounced on him. Woozy, Louis lay there as the bird clubbed him. The planes roared, and the bird and the sirens screamed. Then the planes were gone, the sirens quiet. Dawn broke, and the bird went still. Louis stumbled to his feet and looked northeast. The horizon was glowing with fire. That same night, B-29s showered leaflets over 35 Japanese cities, warning of bombings and urging civilians to evacuate. The Japanese government ordered civilians to turn the leaflets in to authorities, forbade them to share the warnings with others, and arrested anyone with leaflets in their possession. The next morning, Louis's diarrhea was extremely severe. He was dangerously dehydrated and struggling to force food down. The B-29s raked the sky, and the bird rampaged. As Louis crossed camp, the bird collared him and dragged him to the overflowing Benjo pit with several other men. He forced them to their stomachs atop the waste pits and ordered them to do push-ups. When the exhausted men faltered, the bird used his rifle butt to grind their faces into the excrement. Then came the day Louis had been dreading. He was filling a tub of water when the bird barked at him to come, then gestured toward the water. "Tomorrow I'm going to drown you." Louis spent a day gripped in fear, looking for the bird, thinking about drowning. When the bird found him, he was terrified. "I have changed my mind," the bird said. He lunged at Louis and began punching his face, alternating right and left fists in a violent ecstasy. Then he stopped, suddenly serene. "I will drown you tomorrow," he said. Then he strolled away. Louis could take no more. He joined about a dozen officers in a secret meeting. They decided to kill the bird. The plan was simple. They'd leap on the bird and pull him to the barracks' top floor, overlooking the river. There they'd lash him to a rock and shove him out the window. When the bird struck the water, the rock would carry him under. He'd never draw another breath. The officers divvied up the tasks. One group would make a plan to capture the bird. Others would find a heavy rock and sneak it upstairs. Louis was tasked with stealing rope to lash the rock to the bird. The rock crew somehow got a large boulder into the barracks without discovery. Louis couldn't find a rope long enough, so he stole shorter ropes and tied them together. They looped it around the rock, a dangling end ready to be lashed around the bird. The conspirators discussed who would join the group that would capture the bird and throw him to his death. Louis volunteered. On the morning of August 6, 1945, a B-29 skipped off a runway on Tinian Island, next to Saipan. Pilot Paul Tibbetts guided it north toward Japan. In his pocket were poison cyanide capsules. If the plane crashed and the men were captured, they'd swallow the capsules and kill themselves to avoid revealing the new, world-changing secret weapon that sat in the bomb bay, a 12-foot-long, 9,000-pound bomb called Little Boy. It was an atomic bomb. Crossing the inland sea, Tibbetts saw a city ahead, Hiroshima. As the plane crossed over it, the crew donned shaded goggles. Below, Tibbetts saw a T-shaped bridge, the target. The bombardier lined up on it. At 8:15 and 17 seconds, the bombs slipped from the plane. Tibbetts turned the plane sharply and dove to gain speed. It would take 43 seconds for the bomb to reach detonation altitude. No one knew if, in that brief time, the bomber could get far enough away to survive what was coming. A crewman counted seconds in his head. He hit 43. Nothing happened. For an instant, he thought the mission had failed. Exactly as the thought crossed his mind, the sky over the city ripped open in a storm of color, sound, and wind. A white light, 10 times the intensity of the sun, enveloped the plane as the flash and noise and jolt of it skidded out in all directions. Tibbetts' teeth began tingling, and his mouth tasted of lead. He would later be told that it was the metal in his fillings resonating with the radioactivity of the bomb. The entire sky was swirling in pink and blue. The co-pilot scribbled 2 words in his diary. "My God." The tail gunner saw an eerie shimmering warp in the air, ripping toward them at 1,000 feet per second. "Here it comes," he said. The shockwave slammed into the plane, pitching the men into the air and down again. Then came a second wave, a consequence of the force of the explosion hitting the ground and ricocheting up, and the plane heaved again. At a POW camp not far from Hiroshima, a prisoner felt a shudder, and the air warmed strangely. He looked up. A fantastically huge, roiling cloud, glowing bluish gray, stood swaggering over the city. It was more than 3 miles tall. Below it, Hiroshima was boiling. Chapter 31. The Naked Stampede. The POWs knew something big had happened. Guards paced around with stricken faces. Civilians walked past camp, eyes dazed, hands in fists. A civilian told the POWs that one American bomb had destroyed an entire city. He used a word that sounded like atomic. The word was unfamiliar, and no one knew how one bomb could wipe out a city. At Omori, the shaken Japanese commander gathered the POWs. "One plane came," he said, "and a whole city disappeared." He asked if anyone knew what weapon could do such a thing. No one had an answer. On August 9th, the city of Nagasaki, like Hiroshima, disappeared. Uneasy days passed. Everything in Naoetsu remained the same, and the POWs were still sent to labor in the war production factories. Clearly, something monumental had happened, but Japan hadn't given in. For the POWs, time had all but run out. It was nearly mid-August, and the kill-all policy loomed. Even if Japan surrendered, many POWs believed the guards would murder them anyway, out of vengeance, or to prevent them from testifying in war crimes trials. With officials talking about taking them to a new camp, the POWs believed the Japanese planned to murder them in the mountains, where no one would ever find them. Louis lingered in his bunk, fading, praying. In nightmares, he and the bird fought death matches, the bird trying to beat him to death, Louis trying to strangle the sergeant. He'd been staying as far as he could from the bird, but the sergeant always hunted him down. Then, abruptly, the violence stopped. The bird was gone. The guard said he was in the mountains preparing the new camp. The August 22nd kill-all day was 1 week away. On August 15th, Louis woke gravely ill. He was having 20 bloody bowel movements a day. In 1 month, he'd lost 13 pounds from a frame already dangerously thin. His legs were strangely swollen. He'd seen too many men die to be ignorant of what this meant. Potentially fatal beriberi was setting in. In late morning, Louis crept from the barracks. With the bird away, it was safer to walk in the open. He saw Gentle Ogawa, the potato field overseer, one of the few Japanese he didn't fear. But when he saw Louis, Ogawa yanked out his club and struck him in the face. Louis reeled in astonishment, his cheek bleeding. A few minutes later, the compound was suddenly, eerily silent. The Japanese were all gone. In the factories, the POWs realized they were alone. The guards had left. Frank Tinker walked through the deserted Naoetsu compound. Passing the guard room, he glanced inside. There were the guards, crowded around a radio, listening to a small Japanese voice. Something of great importance was being said. At the factories, the guards reappeared and told the POWs to get back to work. When Ken Marvin returned to his station, he found no one working. He spotted Bad Eye, the guard whom he'd been teaching bad English. Marvin asked why work had stopped. Bad Eye said there was no electricity. Marvin looked around, then turned to Bad Eye and told him the lights were on. Bad Eye replied solemnly, "The war is over." Marvin began sobbing. As the workers marched to camp, Marvin hurried among them, sharing what Bad Eye had said. No one believed it. Everyone had heard this rumor before, and it had always turned out to be false. In camp, nothing had changed. In the morning, the work crews were told there was no work and dismissed. The men began to wonder if Marvin was right. The guards would say nothing. A day passed with no news. When night fell, the men saw the village glowing. The civilians had taken their blackout shades down. As a test, the POWs removed the shades on the barracks windows. The guards ordered them to put them back.